whatever Putin is, he's a successful autocrat.
No one in Moscow is ever going to support the collapse of Russia. So this is a pure fantasy. The world has just become a lot richer and more urban and developed in the last 50 or so years. Ukrainians, they want to stay in Ukraine. It's so inspiring to come here. You know, you just see these air raid sirens 3 a.m. every night and stuff. You know, I think, you know, most people would go insane, but people are just, you know, very kind of sensible. To have a democracy, you need opposition. And to have opposition, they need money.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a life and death drama, so yeah. It never gets boring.
About five guys get control of massive resources, and everybody's dependent on them. So guess what? You have an autocracy. So it's not about culture. It's about control over resources.
Paint pretty black pictures or bleak pictures if Russia wins this thing.
I think that's definitely a danger. I don't think Russia's ever going to win.
Hello, everybody. This is Brian Bonner, and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling on Hromadske Radio. We have a special treat. I have in the studio with me Professor Lucan A. Wei. He is the co-director of the Petro Yasek Program for the Study of Ukraine at the University of Toronto, one of the great global capitals, I guess, of Ukrainian diaspora in the world. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks. It's really great to be here.
And you have been, you're neither Canadian nor Ukrainian. You're American, with more degrees than I could stuff inside my head and more knowledge of Ukraine than I have. How did you end up where you are?
In the 1980s, I was a college student, and there was perestroika, and things were happening in the Soviet Union. I came to Moscow and then started living in Ukraine in the 1990s. I was a graduate student, worked as a consultant for the World Bank. I lived in Donetsk for a good 8 months. And then I wrote a book on Ukrainian democracy and why it's Ukraine. You know, it struck me because it's, you know, the most democratic country in the former Soviet Union. I mean, despite everything, all the problems facing Ukraine, despite, you know, Russian aggression, it's remained remarkably democratic, even, I would say, to a remarkable degree during wartime.
What's the scope of the program in Ukrainian studies and popularity? And has that changed during the war?
Well, yeah, no, certainly. So we have, there's a massive Ukrainian diaspora which supports the program, and we have always had a lot of Ukrainian programming, but that obviously stepped up enormously during the full-scale invasion, and we've had, you know, webinars. I had almost two a week at the start, and there's been a tremendous amount of interest. But I think now we've also developed a number of academic programs. I'm actually most happy about, we have a non-residential scholar program that sort of, you know, allows, because initially the response in the United States was, well, you know, that was the idea that we need to get, you know, bring scholars to safety. Mm-hmm. But like Ukrainians, they want to stay in Ukraine, you know, and help out the country. And so my goal is to give funding to Ukrainians who want to stay here, mm-hmm, and fight the fight, but also allow them to do academic work. And so we have seminar, we, you know, use the wonders of Zoom to have seminars and hear about sort of really fantastic research. So that's one thing. And then we also have, the Monk School has a program with the Kiev School of Economics, which is just, you know, so inspiring.
Right.
We, you know, bring over master's students, and we just had a policy brief competition with Ukrainian master's students on issues critical to Ukraine.
So all the teaching and learning doesn't happen just in Toronto.
Right.
Are we talking hundreds of students, thousands of students? I'm just trying to get an idea how wildly popular or not.
Not thousands. I mean, there's a good cohort, you know, 50, 60 students, you know, very interested in Ukraine. And I think, you know, unfortunately, you know, I think the interest in Ukraine, you know, it's interesting, you know, of course, went really up at the beginning of the war because people were so shocked, I think, by the, you know, how atrocious it was. And I think the interest was sustained actually for a much longer time than I thought. I mean, I thought Ukraine fatigue would set in much earlier. But I think, you know, the victories and the fact that it sort of, you know, that Ukraine was able to push back Moscow from the Kiev region, and then success in the counteroffensive in Kharkiv and then Kherson was, of course, I think, sort of kept up the sort of interest in Ukraine. I think, unfortunately, you know, with the sort of difficulties in the more recent counteroffensive that didn't go as well as some had hoped, I think the sort of It's been harder, you know, I think sort of a little bit of Ukraine fatigue has obviously set in, especially in the United States. But.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a life and death drama, so yeah. It never gets boring,
never gets boring.
And I should say, Professor Wei is an author, or co-author, of at least three books,
yep.
including one that I'm reading on the way over here, Pluralism by Default, Weak Autocrats and the Rise of Competitive Politics. And he has two more books along those lines, I guess, with his writing partner, Steve Levitsky, right? Yeah. And the professor studies trends, global trends in democracy and dictatorship. And I read enough of the book, all the Ukraine sections, to know he knows quite a lot about Ukraine. And he's here for four lectures. I attended one of them at the Kyiv School of Economics, but he had three others, also at Kyiv Mihail Academy and other places. Now, professors like to teach, but I know this is your first trip here. You've been here many times and you lived here, but this is your first trip here, you said, since 6 years.
Yeah, since 2018, yeah.
Professors also learn. What did you learn on this trip?
I really had wanted to come. I think my family was a little resistant. I have two 12-year-old boys, and it's so inspiring to come here. You know, you just see, I mean, first of all, the level of sanity in this place is, you know, is just remarkable given, you know, people here are up against. I mean, if I, you know, with these air raid sirens 3 a.m. every night and stuff, you know, I think, you know, most people would go insane, but people are just, you know, very kind of sensible. And I think that's like the first thing. And certainly compared to the United States, you know, it's a striking contrast. But also just the kind of resilience, I think, you know, Ukraine is a place. I was here in the 1990s. I lived near Palat Ukraina, right in the center of Kyiv. And the society has changed so dramatically since then. I mean, that's what I'm sort of struck by, the sort of level of innovation. And I mean, take a place like Kyiv School of Economics. I mean, my God, you know, Timofey Milovanov has just put it all together. You know, he's gotten generators. He's gotten, classrooms in, you know, he has tons of classroom capacity and shelters, on the bomb shelters, so they can, you know, teach under any circumstances. You know, just the level of resourcefulness is, I mean, I almost feel like people should just come here just to kind of learn, you know, resilience. I mean, this is a country which is just remarkable.
Maybe we can do tourism, promote tourism.
No, seriously,
that way.
This is like, I'm not kidding.
I mean, Chernobyl became popular.
Right. But this, yeah, right. It's a lot less dangerous than Chernobyl. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. But yeah, no, it's just, it is like truly inspiring. And, it feels like such a young country too, you know, with the government, and, you know, it's really kind of the energy is just so remarkable. So I think, you know, that struck me. I mean, even you kind of knew that in early 2022 when the victories, but obviously the last 6 months have been a hard time.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not been these sort of, it's far from the heady days. And of course, you know, the view of Zelensky has kind of shifted a bit. I mean, I think, and so, but still, even in this context, I think the fact that people are not just, you know, surviving, but, you know, still kind of in some ways thriving and kind of innovating in this context, I think is just remarkable.
Well, you came here during the morale boost of the U.S. finally approving its
aid,
right?
I was on the train. I had the news that our entire train car sort of, it was a hurrah.
Really?
Yeah,
that
it was great.
So good.
Yeah, that
was such a relief.
Oh my God, yeah.
Now I think the feeling is we can stay in the fight for at least a year.
Yeah, I think, you know, longer term it's a bit worrisome, but I think, you know, for now, you know, the $60 billion is a good chunk of change.
We've been waiting for that. You know, I want to ask you because, you know, it's not democracy and dictatorship, you know, and there's a lot in between. In your analysis of why Russia went in for the full-scale invasion, is it because Ukraine was getting too strong as a society and a democracy, or was it too weak and was seen as easy pickings, or was it none of the above and it was just the imperial impulse?
I used to have a lot of Russian friends until they supported the war and I stopped being their friends. But I've spent
mine are pretty much off my Facebook.
Yeah,
list
so I
now.
Like, you know, that's done. That's a whole other story. It's awful. It's just so depressing. You know, my ex girlfriend from '89 is, you know, pro war. Oh my God. Anyways, but you know, what always struck me was that, you know, the Russians, they know Ukrainians. Many of them have relatives here. They have no idea about Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that I look, you know, that is amazing to me. So I remember, like, the first time it struck me was when during the Orange Revolution, I was, you know, just before I was in Moscow with an old friend, and he was like, you know, you should go. He's a fascist. I'm like, what are you talking about? Yushchenko, I mean, he's like the most mild-mannered guy. He's so not a fascist. Yes. But the fact that they, I think they sort of think they understand Ukraine, but they really don't. And I think so what happened with Putin was, you know, he just says, he looked at, you know, he had the FSB, you know, do these pollings, right, of Ukrainian public opinion. And he, you know, turns out that, you know, Zelensky, as we all know, was not very popular at that point before the invasion.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, so he said, oh, it's a really good picking. So I thought like he saw that as weak and corrupt, and sort of he kind of shared all the stereotypes that everybody else has in the West of, you know, Ukraine being corrupt. So I think it was really, you know, because he thought that it was easy pickings. And I think the other thing important is that, you know, he saw Europe as weak and divided. Right. So the narrative on the left in the United States is that, you know, NATO was being too threatening. But the actual reality is that the problem was it was perceived as too weak. It's really the opposite. It's the weakness of the West and the perceived weakness of Ukraine, which was obviously wrong, that led him to invade.
Isn't that amazing, though, that a neighbor who shares so many ties can get it so wrong?
No, exactly. I just, you know, it's actually sort of interesting, almost psychologically. But there really is such a kind of deep-seated, you know, kind of dismissal of Ukraine as sort of being this provincial. I mean, they just have no idea what it's like here.
And, you've been here since '80. You were here in the Soviet Union.
So I was here, first, I was a student in Moscow, and I stayed at the Libid Hotel.
Right.
In 1989, April of 1989, under, I think it was still Sherbitsky was still in power.
Yeah.
Yep, and so
he
that
was a tough guy.
Yeah, that was, you know, then that was a period when Moscow was much more open and optimistic, and Ukraine felt kind of dead. And my good friend, Chrystia Freeland, I saw her. She's now the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. She was here as a student.
One of the great diaspora.
Another great diaspora, yeah. She was
Canadian,
Ukrainian. Participated in the Ruch and the like. So.
Then you've seen a lot of transitions. And, and I want to ask you about that. I don't know what label you want to use. I mean, we are unconsolidated democracy, fragile democracy, developing democracy. You certainly wouldn't have put Ukraine in the autocracy category.
There's obviously big asterisks because you're in the middle of war and you can't have elections. So that's clear. But, you know, what's remarkable, and I think what people don't quite realize, is how much, you know, in some other, you know, elections is one part of democracy. There's also the legislature. There's also the media. So, to a remarkable extent, given the fact that Ukraine is facing an existential threat, and so it would be very easy to sort of justify, you know, very autocratic measures in Ukraine. I mean, because the threat is real, and you know there are spies, right?
You're right.
This is not like made up stuff, right? But yet the level of openness that is just remarkable given that law and mobilization went through and the number of sort of, you know, amendments and so just, you know, remarkable amount of genuine sort of democratic give and take here that I think is also kind of amazing.
We're in a state of martial law.
Yeah,
and this
exactly.
Invests tremendous powers in the government, which,
right.
You know, can be abused. Now, your book is very interesting because you go all the way from Kravchuk on in the presidents and basically point out where the mistakes they made and why they lost. And I don't need to tell you that Ukrainians are more than happy to vote people out of office.
Yeah.
And do, because we don't know the outcome of our elections.
Yeah.
That's what makes them elections. What are the dangers that Zelensky has to avoid, you know, when he's leading a country at war? And should people be afraid that he's not going to want to give up these powers?
I think you should be. It doesn't matter who the leader is. You should always be afraid they're not going to give up power. I mean, anybody who's a hubristic or self-confident enough to think they could be president of an entire country is never going to want to give it up. That's just the essence of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, I'm sure, you know, no different from anybody else. But within Ukraine, there are enormous constraints because you have a very strong civil society. Also, I mean, you know, this is a little bit less intuitive. I mean, you know, his party is quite weak and fractious. You know, this is no Bolshevik party,
right.
To put it mildly. And so I just don't, you know, I think, my guess is that it'll follow the British, you know, trajectory, which, you know, when Churchill led Britain, Great Britain, during the war, and then the war ended and he was voted out. So that's my...
I say somebody else. Yeah, we still don't have... You put your finger on it in the book. We still don't have a really well-developed party system. They tend to revolve around personalities still, rather than ideologies or structure or tradition.
But ironically, that helps democracy when you have a cohesive political party. They you know, follow the leader. But in this kind of party, you have members of the party of Zelensky's party who are effectively in opposition.
Right.
And so that's, you know, that actually helps pluralism. I mean, that's the irony. And that's, you know, the point of my book.
It's a fascinating discussion and a fascinating book. So I do recommend that people check him out and just go on YouTube and you'll see Luke and Wei's presentations on a lot of issues. Do you think Ukraine will come out of this stronger or weaker?
You know, unfortunately, a lot of that depends on things that are totally outside of Ukraine's control, of course, which is the American Congress. And that's the ultimate tragedy, you know, that sort of the next election, you know, in my home country, the United States, for us is an existential election. But for Ukraine, it really is an existential
election. It can be. Yes.
Yeah, no, that's the thing for Ukraine. You know, so that's, you know.
And
so
I think we share similar views on Donald Trump.
Yeah, no,
and
clearly.
And by that token, Canadian politics is a lot safer territory.
God, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Well, there are, you know, both parties support Ukraine.
So. Is there a global trend that you're seeing in democracy and dictatorship? And because of the situation in Ukraine, what are the potential that either is going to dominate? I mean, people paint pretty black pictures or bleak pictures if Russia wins this thing.
I think that's definitely a danger. I don't think Russia's ever going to win. I think, you know, basically in the sense that, I mean, you know, for the simple reason that, you know, you can't win a colonial war. This is a colonial war. No one's won a colonial war, almost one or two examples, but in 100 years. Right. I mean, Ukraine is just, you know, I mean, it won't be pretty and there's going to be a lot of, you know, death and destruction. But the Ukrainians are never going to do what they're told under a kind of a Putin dictatorship.
Does democracy need Ukraine to win, to flourish?
The point of my book is I think there are other sources of democracy. I mean, you know, I think democracy is certainly in crisis, especially in the United States. It's, you know, in crazy crisis. At the same time, if you look at broader actually trends across all countries, it's actually democracy is doing shockingly well, especially given the fact that, you know, remember in the 1990s, democracy, you know, went way up. It spread enormously in large part because of the Cold War collapse.
The end of history.
Yeah. The collapse of the Soviet Union and the United States was the only, you know, sort of superpower. And, you know, Russia was in disarray and China was still, you know, relatively underdeveloped. But now, of course, since the 2000s, China has become a major global power and Russia, of course, I don't need to tell anybody else, you know, here. And so, but, you know, so in that context, I mean, given the fact that the liberal dominance created the sort of dramatic expansion in democracies, you might think that the reduction of dominance would lead to a dramatic decline in democracy, but that actually hasn't happened. There are about half of countries in the world are democratic.
And there are many elements to democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, do you go with the Freedom House standard or?
Well, I think they all sort of revolve around very similar things, you know, free and fair elections, you know, that sort of, you know, allow opposition to criticize the government, organize
speech,
speeches, you know, anyways, but, you know, there are 100 different measures, but no matter what measure you use, democracy has not actually declined dramatically, even since people talk about the financial crisis of 2008 is, you know, causing a decline in democracy. But you should look at the numbers. It is actually quite stable. So the reason for that, I think, is because, and this is the point of the new book I'm writing with Stephen Levitsky,
right,
is that the world has just become a lot richer and more urban and developed in the last 50 or so years. The irony is that even though the sort of international environment has worsened enormously, and you have, of course, the rise of authoritarian populists, the domestic structural conditions of the economy, the fact that, you know, people, the private property, you know, capitalism has spread, has given sort of, you know, actually quite healthy basis for democratic politics.
Are those prerequisites, education, affluence to democracy?
I think it's pretty essential. So we argue that, you know, having a system of private property, a strong, robust private sector is actually essential because basically, to have a democracy, you need opposition. And to have opposition, they need money. If the state controls all the money, they're never going to get money because the government's never going to give them money. So you need the private sector to give them money. And so the irony is that sort of neoliberal reform of the 1990s that's, you know, many of my student friends were opposed to, actually really actually helped democracy in many ways in the developing world, especially.
Are you of the school that says that there's universal human rights and people have this universal desire for freedom, justice, economic sustainability? Or do you believe that there's cultural reasons why democracies tend not to flourish in the Middle East or Africa, other places?
Yeah, I don't go by for the, you know, I don't go for the cultural arguments. I mean, you look at a place like Kuwait, which before it discovered oil was quite pluralistic. It wasn't a democracy, but it was, you know, power had to be shared between the king and a merchant class, and it was, you know, had a, you know, pretty robust civil society. Guess what? It discovers oil. Suddenly, the government, you know, about five guys get control of massive resources, and everybody's dependent on them. So guess what? You have an autocracy. So it's not about culture. It's about control over resources.
That's the denominator.
Yeah, control over the bucks, in a sense, right? That's what matters. And this is why state control of the economy is so bad for democracy, which is why, I mean, you know, that's why you need a private sector. Separate, you need autonomy from the state, you know, more than anything else. And then you also need to be rich, because, you know, if you're rich, then a lot of people have resources. So you take like a country like Romania, right? Those of you who are old enough to remember Romania in the 1980s, I mean, this was not the place you would expect democracy. It was under this, you know, Stalinist type rule. But now it's a thriving democracy. It's remarkable. And I think a large part is because of capitalist development, which is allowed the opposition, given the opposition, you know, access to resources, you know, is what I think one part of the explanation.
Does being in the EU help?
It absolutely helps.
I mean, set standards and benchmarks.
But it helps. It sets standards, but at the same time, the EU itself is weakening, so it can't just be EU pressure. So
how did, you know, and we both had experience in Russia and Ukraine, and bringing it back to the two nations, how did they end up in such different places? And you know Putin's worldview, he articulated it once, that there's really only five countries in the world, and I mean independent countries in the world, and the rest are kind of satellites of the major countries.
They all miss the sort of good old days when the Soviet Union was a world power, and they're just bitter that that's gone. So much of Russia, they just want to be taken seriously, and so they just can't handle the fact that, you know, people like the Ukrainians would sort of have their own views on things, right? They just can't handle it.
So he really believes it. He's a man of the past.
And yeah, no, you look at his speeches just before the invasion. He had like two speeches, I think, in the 21st and 22nd, 23rd. Anyways, you know, he's kind of this sort of self-taught historian. I don't know what kind of crap he read.
He wouldn't get a good grade in Europe.
No, I mean, he was just like, anyways. But, you know, he wasn't reading from the prompter. This is someone, a true believer, you know, and he really just believes that Ukraine is not a nation, and he's just so angry, you know. And so, anyways, so basically, this is a cranky old man who, because he just has so much power, you know, these are there are a whole bunch of these guys probably all, you know, anywhere in Toronto, whatever, but none of them have the kind of power that he
has. Oil, gas, and nuclear weapons that
exactly.
He has.
His view, I mean, I can tell you because I've lived in the United States, I've spent a lot of time in Russia, and his view of Ukraine is widely shared.
Dismissive.
Incredibly dismissive.
I encountered that too, yes.
Enormous. Russia went into the war way underprepared. And, you know, they just didn't, they thought they could just send it.
Pretty arrogant. But they learn on the fly too, and they have the resources to do that. Yeah. You know, the other thing, are we, sometimes I think we're in a bubble here in Ukraine because we have this, is it wishful thinking to think, oh, he's fragile, he's going to collapse, that there's going to be opposition, that...
Yeah, actually, that's interesting you said. So one sort of line of thinking I've heard a lot here, which really surprises me, which is, I think, you know, is that a lot of people talk about sort of the breakup of Russia here. And I think that's...
You don't see that.
It's pure fantasy.
Pure fantasy.
Pure fantasy. And I think so, you know, we all, you know, most of us, you know, a lot of us remember the fall of the Soviet Union, which collapsed very quickly. But why did that fall? It fell because the, you know, person at the center of power, Yeltsin in Moscow, wanted it to fall because he wanted to overthrow Gorbachev. And so that's why it fell so easily, you know. But there's no one in Moscow is ever going to support the collapse of Russia. So this is a pure fantasy.
Okay, so we should get over that.
I don't know where that comes from. I can understand emotionally where that comes from, because, you know, I would want Russia to disappear too if I were living here too. But it's not going to happen. I mean, well, you know, I wish it would.
Well, we know, we know in a small nation we need alliances and so forth. And one, I don't know what you see a way out of it, whether Russia is capable of democracy. And I preface that by saying what I saw in Ukraine in the time I first came in 1996 to now, which is 28 years later, is Ukrainians are actually citizens of the world, literally, sometimes. And so compared to Russia, they have a much more worldly view, and Russia's just gone down this real isolationist path.
Yeah, no, it's really true. It's just so awful. I don't buy this idea that sort of culturally Russians can never be democracy, or history goes in strange ways. But the problem is that Putin's not going anywhere.
And he's quite healthy, I guess.
Is he?
For 71. That was the other things we read
about.
Yeah,
that's all speculation.
His news, his health.
Yeah, we're all sort of looking at his, you know, his complexion and hoping.
And the other thing is, okay, and I guess this brings up the real point, because you like to ask big provocative questions, so I'll turn it around and ask you. How and why do autocracies succeed or fail? And the same thing for democracies, because whatever Putin is, he's a successful autocrat.
If you had asked anybody, any Russia specialist in 2021, you said, well, imagine a scenario where the Russian president goes to war and thousands of his own people die. Would Putin survive? You say, no way. Because actually Putin before 2022 was incredibly cautious. I mean, he invaded Crimea, but he always, or Georgia in 2008, but he always took over areas that were kind of sympathetic to Russia.
He had softened up the ground.
Just historically, there's a lot of Russia speakers. Right? Something happened in COVID with him, and then he just does this, you know, completely insane thing. I mean, insane on a lot of levels. Anyways, but, you know, yet 2 years in, I mean, he is no weaker, sadly, than he was before. And so I think that's been the kind of shock to all of us, just is how strong he is.
So is ruthlessness a part of success for Xi and Putin and the Iranian mullahs?
Part of my argument is that, this is another book that just came out in 2022 on the revolutionary dictatorships, which is that, you know, the social revolution, like in Russia in 1917, China in 1949, you know, they emerge out of violent conflict, and that forces them to create these very robust security apparatus, very robust militaries. And so in Iran, you have a Revolutionary Guard, which is incredibly powerful, that emerged out of the Iran-Iraq War. Russia, of course, is not a revolutionary regime in that sense. The Soviet Union collapsed. But, you know, Putin just was really lucky. He inherited two things from the Soviet era. One is an incredibly weak civil society, right? Mm-hmm. You had 70 years of totalitarianism, which was wiping out any form of Russian civil society that existed. And so you had weak society there. And then, he also had obviously an incredibly strong coercive apparatus of the KGB, right? The world's strongest coercive apparatus ever. So, you know, Russia emerges, it's an unfair battle, because on one side you have society, which is just incredibly disorganized, and a political police, which is just has all the skills and resources you could possibly imagine.
Now, we had that on a smaller scale here, though, in Ukraine.
Yeah.
We had Kuchma and Yanukovych, who were aspiring autocrats.
Yeah.
And we had the same KGB apparatus.
Yeah.
We came to a different place.
Well, you also had regional divisions, and you had, Galicia, right? So, and I think that was...
But do you see a strain in Ukrainian history that they just... there's not an autocratic... it's a more democratic, less autocratic culture?
Well, I don't know about the culture, but I think things are more divided. So, it's just, regionally. So I think having the regional divisions, which are much more significant,
You see that as a big factor.
I see that as a big factor. So in some ways, because if you look at sort of Ukraine before 2014, this is part of my book, is that you look at turnover, it's always between a kind of Russophile versus Ukrainophile, right? That's the kind of, there weren't parties because the parties were very weak, but it was kind of regionalized, centers of power. And, And so the voting was always, you know, it wasn't stable east-west, but it was, you know, definitely that was divided. And so
if Yanukovych would have been a tougher autocrat, could be living in Putin land.
No, it's not about toughness. He, you know, it wasn't about toughness. He was pretty tough in February of 2014.
Right.
But you had that he couldn't control, no matter what, he couldn't control the West. So, you know, large parts of the army, you know, just defected.
He lost control,
which was inevitable. So, you know, his mistake was overplaying his hand. He was too tough, right? You know, but the massacre on the Maidan.
There are a lot of examples, and you know better than I do, of autocracies that become democracies or arguably democracies. How does that process start? And once you are in that camp, I mean, I assume you believe the staying power of democracies depends on quite a few factors.
In political science, the transition from dictatorship to democracy happens for a whole number of oftentimes completely random reasons. So, you know, why did transition happen in Eastern Europe? Well, you know, it was mainly because you just had a guy, Gorbachev, come to power who just decided he didn't want to, have Eastern Europe, you know, he didn't want to expend the resources to keep Eastern Europe in the Soviet sphere. That was just pure luck. I mean, that was kind of random. As I say in Russia,
it was a fortunate stroke of history.
Yeah, subjektivne faktory history, right? You know, subjective factors. But then the question is, what happens afterwards, right? So I think, you have, like in Africa, you know, you have transitions, but then because, control of resources is much more centralized, it's very easy to return to autocracy. So those places that stay are those that are sort of rich capitalist countries, like South Korea, among the high income countries, in the world, not including oil cases, 97% of them are democracies. The only exceptions are Hungary and Singapore. So it's as I say in social science, it's both necessary and probably sufficient to become a democracy is to be rich capitalist.
All right. That's another great reason for prosperity and sharing of the resources. Well, we would take hours more if we talked about Canadian and American politics. So we should probably wrap it up and leave it there because I know you're here on a short time schedule. You got a lot of things to do and a lot of people to see. But when is your next book? When do you hope to have that out?
Well, I'm always too optimistic. I would say about a year.
About a year?
So, yeah, we're hoping to get it out.
When you partner, how does that work? He writes a chapter, you write a chapter, or you,
well, you know, it's just, we're just
edit each other?
No, we're just like very good friends, and we just end up, so we write different chapters together, but we almost end up always agreeing. So
it's on the same space. That's great. Well, that's why he's your partner. And the solo book, that was a good experience without your partner?
No, that was good. That was my kind of heart and soul. That was from years of, living in Moscow in 1991.
Yeah, you took it. Sounded great. I recommend this book, Pluralism by Default, Weak Autocrats and the Rise of Competitive Politics. It's a really good book. And I look forward to the other two with your partner, too. Well, Professor, thanks for bringing a taste of Toronto.
Thank you.
To downtown Kyiv. And we wish you safe travels, and we hope that you come back more often.
Yeah, no, I would love to.
That's it for this week's program. I invite you all to watch us on YouTube, on Hromadske Radio's website, where the transcript will be up pretty soon, and also wherever you get your podcast. This is Brian Bonner on behalf of Ukraine Calling. We'll see you again next week.